All right. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this exciting program and to kick off this exciting meeting. It's really a pleasure to be here, especially for those of us who come from colder climates or are enduring the warm weather. So I'm Zosia Piotrowska. I'm a thoracic medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and I'm really honored to be joined by two excellent expert faculty for this program, Bruna Pollini from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, and Alice Shaw from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. So our focus today is the treatment of metastatic ALK-positive lung cancer. We're going to do this in three modules. So we're going to have, for each module, you can see them on your agenda, we're going to have a short didactic going through some of the data and best practices here, and then also a panel discussion for a few minutes after each didactic session. So for the panel discussion, just a reminder to please submit your questions through the iPad, and we'll try to get through as many of them as we can. So let's start with a few slides on best practices in molecular testing for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. We're going to actually kick things off with a case. This is a 51-year-old man who was referred to oncology clinic from primary care after 6 months of chronic cough, shortness of breath, and chest pain. As you can see, he's fairly healthy, has some history of depression and hyperlipidemia. Importantly, no history of tobacco use. And a CT scan of the chest shows a 4.8-centimeter mass in the left hilum with enlarged subcarinal, paratracheal, and left supraclavicular lymph nodes. He also is noted to have lytic lesions and several ribs. So staging is ordered with a PET scan and a brain MRI. And in parallel, this patient was referred to interventional pulmonology, who performed endobronchial ultrasound sampling of the subcarinal and paratracheal lymph nodes. As you can see, both of these came back positive for a TTF1 positive adenocarcinoma with a PD-L1 score of 80%. So just a brief few words on biomarker testing. I hope that among all the topics we're going to cover in this session, this is familiar to all of you, which is the importance of molecular testing for all patients with advanced and now increasingly also with early stage non-small cell lung cancer. Really, this is incredibly critical for our patients with non-small cell lung cancer because you want to take patients from this kind of general pool of patients with non-small cell lung cancer and hone in on the specific subtypes of lung cancer because of the critical implications for treatment that this has. As you can see from this pie chart, now with targeted therapies available for a number of different biomarkers, nearly half of patients will have something that can be potentially targeted, identified on NGS. And so it's really critical that we're doing this testing. In fact, the NCCN guidelines, as you all know, really recommend molecular testing, including a broad panel that includes all of the targets for which we have targeted therapies for now, EGFR, ALK, KRAS, ROS1, BRAF, NTRK, MET exon 14 skipping, RET, HER2, NRG1 now, and HER2 IHC, as well as PD-L1. And I added to the NCCN guidelines a few editorial comments, which is that, of course, the molecular testing should be comprehensive. We have to look at the tests we're ordering and ensure that they're covering all of these panels. But it also has to be timely in the sense that we really need to be ordering this ASAP at initial diagnosis, or perhaps you're at an institution where it's reflexed, but also resulted. And you have to review those results before you initiate first-line therapy. All of that helps us ensure that patients are getting the best treatment. This is a symposium on ALK-positive lung cancer, so just a few words on the complex world of testing for ALK. There's a number of different ways that one can assess for ALK rearrangements in non-small cell lung cancer. And to kind of briefly summarize, the ones that are recommended are ALK immunohistochemistry, which can often be used as a screening method, as well as NGS-based panels. So you can see on the left here in the box, ALK-IHC, which is a highly specific test for ALK because ALK protein is generally not expressed in normal lung tissue. So if you do see ALK-IHC positive, that is very likely to have an ALK rearrangement. NGS, of course, I think is the way that many of us find these ALK fusions, but I will highlight that DNA NGS can sometimes detect these, but adding in the RNA-based NGS platform can really increase your yield for rearrangements, including ALK, as well as a number of other fusion oncogenes, as you can see. This figure in the middle here is from a study from Memorial Sloan Kettering where they really showed that when you take patients who have no targetable alterations on a DNA-based NGS panel, up to about a quarter to a third of them will actually have a fusion identified on RNA NGS. And so I think it's really critical to think about RNA-based testing for these patients. A key advantage here is that you can also get not only the presence of an ALK fusion, but the fusion partner. In the past, we used a lot of ALK fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH, which is looking for the breakup part of the red and green signal to indicate an ALK fusion is present. However, I would say this is a technically challenging test with a high degree of inter-reader variability, and so it has somewhat fallen out of favor, and we really favor ALK-IHC and NGS, and we can certainly talk about the methods used at our different institutions. What about the role of liquid biopsies? Of course, they play an important role in testing, and the figure on the left here really highlights the different approaches to liquid biopsies that one can take. I think the one that many of us have moved to now is a complementary approach where you're really ordering both tissue and liquid biopsy at the time of initial meeting the patient, hoping that the liquid biopsy will detect something even while the tissue is still cooking. It's also reasonable to get tissue first and think about liquid biopsy if that tissue is insufficient. But I will say, again, specifically with the lens of thinking about ALK, we have to remember that the sensitivity of ctDNA-based assays for the detection of fusions, such as ALK and ROS1, is more limited than what we typically think about, for example, for EGFR mutations and others. So you can see here in this figure on the right of the slide that in a series of patients with ALK and ROS1 positive lung cancers identified on tissue testing, the sensitivity of ctDNA was only about two-thirds, about 67% for both of those fusions. And so I think in particular, when in patients who have where you're looking for fusion oncogenes such as ALK and ROS1, liquid biopsy does have some key limitations to be aware of. If it's helpful if it's positive, but not so helpful if it's negative. So why do we care so much about timely testing? Again, hopefully this is familiar to all of you, but I think a key message here is that there is risk to starting immunotherapy too early and then later finding one of these oncogenes where a targeted therapy can be used. We certainly know this with patients who receive osimertinib after PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors, where we see high rates of pneumonitis, colitis, and other immune-related adverse events. Up to 15% of patients will have a serious adverse event if the osimertinib is started within 3 months of an immune checkpoint inhibitor. I would say that as we've moved away from this practice, we have less opportunity to look retrospectively at this with some of the newer ALK inhibitors, but in a series that was published by Dr. Shaw and colleagues showed that actually there was high rates of hepatotoxicity also seen when crizotinib was used after immunotherapy, as high as about 45% of patients having significant hepatotoxicity. So there is certainly risk, and I think that's the key reason not to initiate immunotherapy until you're really confident that you've completed full molecular testing. So let's take a few minutes to discuss these points, and then we'll move on to the next didactic. So maybe while we're waiting for any questions to come in the iPads, I can start by asking both of you, again, specifically thinking about this question of looking for ALK-positive disease, as that is our focus. What is your practice now? How do you find most of these? Are you using IHC, NGS, both? Alice, maybe we'll start with you and then go to Bruna.
Sure. I think our practice is probably pretty similar, Zosha. Certainly tissue and liquid we submit in parallel. For tissue, we do prefer to do a rapid ALK IHC test. Typically, we can get that back in just a few days, which is great. And as Zosha mentioned, there's a lot of advantages to immunohistochemistry, especially over FISH, for example, kind of the older gold standard. We also do have NGS cooking at the same time, so that's a nice confirmation as well if they are identified as ALK IHC positive. And as Zosha mentioned, the NGS does give us information around the exact ALK fusion, the partner, the breakpoints, et cetera.
Yeah, similar practice as well, liquid and NGS in parallel. I will say that probably like 5-10% we have QNS issues with tissue, then absolutely doing an ALK IHC is something that we can do quickly, and we have it available in-house, so we have done that in the past.
And just to kind of hone in on this IHC question, if you had a patient, you go to start treatment and ALK IHC returns positive, do you feel comfortable ordering that TKI and starting treatment, or do you have to wait for the confirmation?
No, I do feel comfortable. Curious, Bruna, if you do as well. I mean, there have been a lot of studies demonstrating that the ALK IHC positivity is predictive of course, having an ALK rearrangement and sensitivity to ALK TKI. We don't express ALK normally in the lung, so it's a very clean IHC, and so any positivity does indicate that there's ALK expression, and that almost always is related to an underlying chromosomal rearrangement. So we do start a TKI based on the IHC.
Yeah, I agree completely. I had conversations with our molecular pathologist because I had questions a few years ago, and she shared all the studies that you mentioned. So.
And Bruna, you've done a lot of work on ctDNA. You know, kind of same question, if you find an ALK fusion on a liquid biopsy, do you wait for the tissue to confirm it, or do you feel you can act on this?
No, I believe it. The sensitivity is the limiting factor, but the specificity is extremely high, so you can trust it.
Kind of the same approach that we think about for all the oncogenes. When liquid biopsies are positive, they're helpful, and when they're negative, you really have to be cautious
more.
And keep searching. So it doesn't look like we have any questions on the iPad, but again, a reminder to please enter them. I think maybe one other question, you know, this issue of the ALK fusion partner or variant, you know, we don't get that, for example, if we have a patient who has ALK IHC, at least initially, until we get those NGS results back, or, you know, how important is that in your decision making? You know, that either the fusion partner or the specific variant, does that impact how you choose treatment?
You know, right now it doesn't. We're going to talk a lot about the CROWN trial in just a second. Yeah. That's the first line study, of course, comparing lorlatinib to crizotinib. And actually, we did look at the 5-year analysis at outcomes to lorlatinib based on EML4 ALK variant. And actually, the outcomes to lorlatinib were similar between the main two variants, variant 1 and variant 3, actually. And so, from a standpoint of prescribing lorlatinib, I think the variant itself does not impact the choice of first-line therapy.
Yeah, I think it mattered more before the CROWN data was available, but I feel with the data you're going to share, Dr. Shaw, we may feel differently after the session.
Great. Well, if there are no other questions, maybe in the interest of time, I think we're all excited to review that data and start thinking about how do we treat this patient that we're talking about. So I'll introduce Dr. Shaw. Oh, sorry.
Here we go. Great to see everyone. Thank you so much for joining. We're going to pick up from where Zosha left off with this case. So as Zosha mentioned, the patient she presented did undergo staging scans, including a PET scan, which did demonstrate FDG uptake in the left lung mass, also the mediastinal and supraclavicular lymph nodes, and the multiple bony sites that were visualized on the CT scan. Fortunately, though, the staging brain MRI was negative, so no brain metastases at diagnosis. And so this patient was diagnosed with advanced stage 4B ALK-positive lung cancer. Before we go right into the data, though, I wanted to provide this kind of high-level overview of the therapeutic landscape for advanced ALK-positive lung cancer. This is a summary of first and then the multiple next generations of ALK inhibitors that have been developed over about the last 18 years, starting with, of course, crizotinib, our first-generation inhibitor, going all the way out to our most recent fourth-generation inhibitor, NVL-655. And just to summarize, I would say briefly in the interest of time, each successive generation of ALK inhibitor really was developed to be more potent, more selective for ALK, also more CNS or brain penetrant, and also as we got further out, to actually be able to cover more and more of the ALK resistance mutations that were being defined in many studies of resistance to these ALK inhibitors. And so again, crizotinib was the first ALK inhibitor in the clinic back in 2007, and very soon after crizotinib, you can see there was a whole sort of class of second generation, more potent ALK inhibitors like alectinib and brigatinib, and there are even others that I haven't listed here. And then in 2014, we had the entry of lorlatinib, a third generation ALK inhibitor, into the clinic. This one was very specifically designed to overcome all known single ALK resistance mutations and specifically designed to penetrate the brain to high levels. And then, as I just mentioned, just a few years back, a company, Nuvalent, brought even a fourth generation ALK inhibitor, NVL-655, also called neladalkib now, into the clinic, and the early data are looking very promising. So here's the landscape of the ALK inhibitors that we have in the clinic. Now, what do NCCN guidelines tell us? So here you can see that NCCN does list 4 preferred category 1 first line options. So for the patient that we just discussed, NCCN says that we could prescribe a second generation ALK inhibitor like alectinib, brigatinib, or ensartinib, or the third generation ALK inhibitor, lorlatinib.
Just to note here, again, my commentary for on these guidelines, they mentioned that perhaps you could consider ceritinib or crizotinib. I would say we really don't consider those. Ceritinib is an older second-generation ALK inhibitor that has a lot more GI toxicities, and so we pretty much never reach for that one. And of course, crizotinib has already been beaten by all of these second and third generation ALK inhibitors in randomized trials, so I think we very rarely would ever consider those two. But of the second and third generation ALK inhibitors, which one would we select for this patient? So let's look at the data on second generation ALK inhibitors used in the first line setting. So this is taken from four separate phase three randomized trials for alectinib, brigatinib, and ensartinib. Those second generation ALK inhibitors were compared head-to-head to crizotinib as first line therapy in advanced ALK positive lung cancer. You can see on the left that the second generation ALK inhibitors are highly active. They induce responses in most patients. 71 to 83% of patients will achieve a response, often these dramatic responses. And then on the right, you can see a summary of the median progression-free survival based on blinded independent central review of these second-generation ALK inhibitors. And you can see in these cases that alectinib, brigatinib, and ensartinib are pretty similar in providing a median PFS in the 24 to 26 month range, so about 2 years or so. In two cases, brigatinib and alectinib, they did follow patients for longer on these phase three trials, and the investigator-assessed median progression-free survival was a bit longer, so about 31 to 35 months or so with frontline alectinib or frontline brigatinib. And so I do think if we decided to select alectinib or brigatinib for this patient, we would expect 2 or 3 years of PFS or a time where there's no evidence of progression or resistance developing. But now I think all of that has been kind of overshadowed by the results of the CROWN trial. So just as a reminder, the CROWN trial was a global phase three study comparing lorlatinib versus crizotinib as first-line therapy in advanced ALK-positive lung cancer. Most of the patients enrolling on this trial were like the one we just presented, stage four ALK-positive lung cancer, ECOG performance status 0 to 2, untreated asymptomatic brain metastases were allowed in this trial, and patients in this trial did have to have measurable extracranial disease. You can see that patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive either lorlatinib as their first therapy or crizotinib, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival by blinded independent central review with pretty standard secondary endpoints, as you can see here. So this data has been published. I'll go quickly through this. We reported the results of a planned interim analysis on the left, and then also an unplanned analysis after a median follow-up of 3 years on the CROWN trial. You can see at both time points, lorlatinib was significantly superior to crizotinib as first-line therapy. Median progression-free survival at each of these time points was not reached with lorlatinib and was about 9.3 months or so with crizotinib as expected. The hazard ratio, as you can see here, was about 0.28, so highly statistically significant. This didn't change the field too much. I already told you that with alectinib and brigatinib, we could sometimes see median PFS going out to 3 years or even beyond. But I think what really did shift the field for many of us is the most recent long-term follow-up of the CROWN study, now after a median follow-up of 5 years. And so this was presented by Ben Solomon at ASCO last year. And here you can see, after this follow-up of 5 years, the median PFS with first-line lorlatinib has still not been reached. Again, with crizotinib, it's as expected in that 9 month range. The hazard ratio is even better at about 0.19, corresponding to an 81% reduction in the risk of progression or death. And you can see that if you just focus at that 5 year time point, that the PFS rate with first line lorlatinib is about 60%, compared to crizotinib coming in at about only 8%. Now, just also to note, after this median follow-up of 5 years, the response rate was significantly higher with lorlatinib as well, coming in at about 81% versus 63%. And just to mention that, not surprisingly, overall survival continues to be followed, but is still quite immature in this study at 5 years. I did want to show this slide, which shows that the PFS benefit that we see with lorlatinib really does apply across all of the pre-specified patient subgroups, as you can see here. And in particular, I wanted to highlight those patients with and without baseline brain metastases. And you can see, again, both of these subgroups of patients did derive significantly more benefit from lorlatinib than crizotinib, particularly those patients with baseline brain metastases, where here you can see the hazard ratio came down to about 0.08. Now, going a little bit further into the intracranial activity with lorlatinib in the CROWN study, I think this was pretty remarkable as well to many of us here, showing that after a median follow-up of 5 years, 92%, so almost all of the patients who were treated with lorlatinib first line, remained free of intracranial progression, which is pretty remarkable. I mean, this almost flat curve for lorlatinib I thought was really striking. The time to intracranial progression for lorlatinib, the median was not reached yet. As you can see here, again, hazard ratio 0.06. For patients who had measurable intracranial disease, the confirmed intracranial response rate with lorlatinib was 92%. So almost every patient responded to lorlatinib. And then I would just make a note that this study, we really did want to rigorously assess intracranial activity. So for all patients, regardless of their baseline brain met status, all patients had mandatory brain imaging every 8 weeks throughout the course of the study. Just for comparison, how do second-generation ALK inhibitors perform? We know they also have brain activity, but I wanted to provide this comparison with as a sort of an example of brigatinib. So for brigatinib in the first-line ALTA study, we know that the 3-year intracranial PFS rate with brigatinib was about 57%. And at 4 years, the intracranial PFS rate with brigatinib dropped down to 46%. And as you can see on these curves from CROWN, for lorlatinib, the 4-year intracranial PFS was about 92%, so pretty much double. So significantly higher intracranial activity with lorlatinib. Lorlatinib not only treats brain metastases, but also appears to be able to protect the brain from developing metastases. Actually, I'm going to skip this because we talked about it, and just maybe end here in the interest of time. I do want to acknowledge that all these comparisons are, of course, are cross-trial, so there are lots of caveats with doing these types of cross-trial comparisons, but I think you can get a sense that by comparing across these trials, lorlatinib does seem to be significantly more active. Here I've summarized the median PFS with our second-generation inhibitors that are commonly used, like alectinib and brigatinib, coming in at about 31 to 35 months, as I said, but with lorlatinib, the median PFS, even after a follow-up of 5 years, not reached yet. And if you think, well, maybe we can use these TKIs sequentially, so we can do alectinib followed by lorlatinib, and so a sequential second-gen, third-gen TKI approach. We know from previous studies of lorlatinib that lorlatinib does have activity after failure of alectinib or brigatinib, but the activity is somewhat limited. Median PFS is only about 6 months in that setting. So even if you use sequential TKIs, the combined PFS doesn't appear to be as long as the upfront PFS we get with first-line lorlatinib. And so for this reason, I would say for most of the patients that I'm meeting who have newly diagnosed advanced ALK-positive lung cancer, like the one in this case, I'm recommending first-line lorlatinib. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for that great summary, and it's really so incredible to see the data, you know, these survival curves, PFS curves out beyond 5 years. This is terrific. So we do have one question, which is about kind of later line treatment in the on the iPad, but I just wanted to tackle that first. So how would you approach a patient with positive ALK-IHC, negative rearrangement, progressed on crizotinib, had partial response to carbopemetrexed, then gemcitabine, and is doing very well? Would you rechallenge with an ALK targeting agent again? It's, you know, I think there's probably maybe two ways to answer this question. I'm not sure what negative rearrangement means, whether that means that, NGS was negative, or, you know, maybe we can talk about that, but also just if you had an ALK-positive patient who progressed on crizotinib and then had chemo, you know, is there a role for rechallenge with ALK TKIs?
I would also wonder how the negative rearrangement was defined. Was that a DNA NGS, or was that really RNA testing, which is oftentimes better for picking up fusions? But also, progressed on crizotinib, I'd need to know, did they have an initial response to crizotinib, or was it really primary progression to crizotinib? If they had an initial response to crizotinib, I, of course, would favor that they do probably have a true ALK rearrangement. I think if the patient's doing well right now on gemcitabine, I would definitely be trying to investigate the diagnostics more here and probably trying to repeat the ALK testing, especially if it's another modality besides IHC, so NGS I think would be ideal.
It's a great point. I think, you know, sometimes we have to go back to the drawing board and really ask ourselves, was the testing that was done comprehensive, and, you know, do we have all the information to kind of really understand? We've had cases like this where patients are found to have a different oncogene driver, so really critical. I think another question, I had the same question, and maybe this is one for both of you. So if you're using upfront lorlatinib, which I think many of us have now moved to, what is your starting dose? And Bruna, I know we'll get to this in your talk with regards to toxicity management, but even before that, I'll start with you, Bruna, and then Alice as well. Do you start at a 75 milligrams or 100 milligrams?
Elder patients, because I worry about the cognition side effects, I have started with 75. But if it's a young patient, no comorbidities, I would be willing to start with 100 milligrams.
You know, actually, my practice is to start patients at 75 milligrams, only because we've had so much experience using lorlatinib now at 100 milligrams, and so many patients do have some toxicities, which Bruna's going to tell us about, that can make it very difficult for them. And I find 75 milligrams often is a good kind of test for patients. And if they're doing really well on 75 milligrams, I will escalate them to the full dose of 100 milligrams. But I do like the 75 milligram dose. I think you might mention this, Bruna, but in the CROWN trial, we did look at patients in the CROWN trial who did have a dose reduction to during the first 16 weeks of treatment with lorlatinib. And we did show that those patients did about the same in terms of PFS and intracranial PFS to those patients who did not need a dose reduction. And so I think we do have at least some data to support the 75 milligram dose.
I do have a question. Do you ever start anyone on 50 milligrams?
I do, and I just did. I just did recently, only because, again, it was a patient kind of like what you were saying. So a patient who may be older, who may have some other comorbid disease that makes me worry about their ability to really tolerate the side effects, I might even start as low as 50 milligrams, but generally it's at 75.
Awesome. All right. I want to make sure we have time to get to the hot topic of toxicity management, but two more quick questions that have come in. So one, Bruna, I'll punt this to you. With the intracranial activity of lorlatinib, is there still a situation where we think about radiation or even surgery for these patients?
Not at the beginning of therapy. I would, with these amazing responses that we're seeing, I would start with the targeted therapy.
Yeah, I'd love to just emphasize that, because I'm still seeing a lot of patients that refer to me. They're newly diagnosed. They had literally 5 millimeter brain mets, and they've already been SRS'd. And we know those patients almost certainly would have had complete resolution of those brain mets. And so I would just emphasize that this drug is highly CNS penetrant. It can and should control the CNS disease even probably better than our traditional modalities.
We used to talk about that with whole brain radiation therapy, but it's interesting that now, you know, as we've moved the needle forward on CNS penetrant therapies, even SRS, which we think of as benign, when these patients are living such a long time, you can certainly see long-term toxicity. So I think that's a really, really important point. I will often follow these patients together with radiation oncology, but I try to urge them to hold off as much as possible. So we have a few more questions, but I think what I'm going to do is maybe move, Bruna, to your talk, and then we can tackle the last few questions at the end. So with that, we'll move on to toxicity management, I think a really clinically important topic as we talk about these ALK TKIs.
Okay, so continuing the case, so that patient started a lorlatinib, we're going to start as first line. You meet with the patient does have caregivers, and you're going to discuss the potential side effects and the plan for reporting and managing those. So let's talk about this. So if you look at the table of adverse events, so definitely the high cholesterol and triglycerides are the most common side effects seen. But I do want to point out that there are other side effects that happen in over a third of the patients, so such as edema, increase in weight, peripheral neuropathy, which I know is something that we probably will cover during our discussion. And we do have to talk about the cognitive side effects and the mood effects as well. But I'm going to start with the high cholesterol. And finally, my cardiology research in med school is panning out to be useful as an oncologist. So because 70% of the patients will have the side effect, we really need to go back to our internal medicine and know how to manage this. So how do I treat this patient? So very nice source of information up to date. I love it. Very quick and easy to use in clinic. But if you have an LDL that is over 190, please start this patient in a high-intensity statin. And a high-intensity statin is atorvastatin of 40 or 80 milligrams or rosuvastatin of 20 or 40 milligrams. It's up to you if you're going to start at the 40 or 20 milligrams is still high intensity, and those patients may already be on a statin if they have other comorbidities, so if they have CAD and diabetes, they should be on it already. Now, if your patient doesn't have a baseline hyperlipidemia, doesn't have a high LDL, how do we determine if we start or not? Let's say it's somebody young that doesn't have any of those comorbidities. Ideally, our cardiology folks would like us to look into their cardiovascular risk, and we can easily calculate that. But I'd like to say that based on the trial, because so many patients end up developing the side effect, they encouraged the investigators to even start a statin, even if it was a grade 1 hyperlipidemia that we were seeing. So I do want to point out that the dosing is a little bit different if you're going to choose a moderate intensity statin. So atorvastatin would be 10 or 20 milligrams. And rosuvastatin would be 5 to 10. Prevastatin is another option. There are other two statins that you can also use without interactions, but I do want to say avoid simvastatin and lovastatin. They do have some interactions, and they can have issues with the dose concentrations. So just remember that for the sake of treating CAD and all other comorbidities and this side effect, I would choose rosuvastatin and atorvastatin, even if it's a moderate intensity, because if you have to increase the dose, you're already using one of the drugs that you can go to 80 or 40 milligrams. But if you do want to calculate the risk of your patient from a cardiovascular standpoint, you can just input in this algorithm. You can go to MDCalc. It's very easy to gather the information. You just need some baseline characteristics that I listed here on the right side of this. Now, because we are awesome oncologists and we saw this lecture, we're going to start our patient in a statin, okay? And ideally, you should check that within 4 to 6 weeks, your lipid panel, to see if the patient is having a response. If they are not and the LDL is still over 100, you have the ability to add a second agent that is a non-statin agent. So you can do ezetimibe, you can do bempedoic acid. I have never used that even in my cardiology research times, the second one. But ezetimibe, some patients are already on that. And then it's once a day, they can take it any time. Statins in general, we want to give them at nighttime, so just remember that. And myalgias can happen with statins as well. Now, you did all of that. You're this awesome medonk, and still, the LDL is not budging. It's still over 100. This is the time you have to call a friend. You really shouldn't be managing this hyperlipidemia by yourself. At least I urge you not to. And then they'll probably look into other therapies, such as the PCSK9 inhibitors. Some of us might have seen these agents because there are some IITs in thoracic oncology combining them with immunotherapy. However, I would urge you not to do that by yourself. And they're very expensive drugs. You may have issues with coverage, and we already deal with a lot. So let's call the cardiologist. Mood effects, because that patient had depression, I did want to bring this up. There's about 16% of the patients that will have that. And there's no major interaction with SSRIs and SNRIs. How do I know this? I did a quick check in Micromedics. So you can always do that. But most of us have pharmacists in clinics, so ask your pharmacist. They are a wonderful resource. Or call a friend. I have my Rolodex in my cell phone. I just call my best friend psychiatrist if I have any questions. So you can start your patient on any of these drugs if you want to. In terms of cognitive side effects, I think it's super important, and I think we're going to discuss, but it's about 21% of the patients. So how do you treat that? I think it's important to know the half-life of the drug. So it's 24 hours. So if a patient's having a grade 3, by all means, we have to hold the lorlatinib, and you have to wait until that reduces to a grade 1. So if you calculate the half-life in about 5 days, that drug should be out of the system, so you can recheck the patient perhaps in a week, and then decide what you're going to do. If it's a grade 1, you may continue. You don't really need to hold the drug. If it's a grade 2, then you can continue or withhold. Personally, I would prefer holding a little bit, and then we can reassess the dose. I'm curious to see how you feel about it, Dr. Shah, Dr. Piotrowska. But that's from the original protocol. In doubt, when you have a side effect that you don't know what to do, you can call Dr. Shah, Dr. Piotrowska, or you can look at the original protocol. So just don't be shy. I always go to protocols if I want a quick answer and I cannot get a hold of anyone. And these are from the original protocol as well. So dose level was 100 milligrams, the DL minus 1 was 75, and DL minus 2 was 50. Curious to see if you ever decrease below the 50. And like Dr. Shah mentioned, this data to me is beautiful. I love knowing that, and I wish every single trial had that analysis, because it's showing us that basically the ones that had a dose reduction represented by the straight line on the top are the ones that are doing very well. Great PFS, great time to intracranial progression, even with a dose reduction. So that's why I think it's a great strategy to start everyone in 75. And I think, like Dr. Shah said, within 16 weeks, you're supposed to see some of the side effects and then decide on the dose changes. But I love this data, so remember that. And thank you very much.
Wonderful. Great overview, and I think so many practical points. I think these are things that we all have to get comfortable with these days. So maybe one question which I think kind of addresses both the second and the third module, which you nicely highlighted the potential side effects of lorlatinib. A question for both of you. Are there any kind of baseline conditions that might sway you away from lorlatinib, where you actually might preferentially pick a second-generation ALK inhibitor because you're worried that the toxicities of these agents are just too high? Alice, I'll start with you.
I think the main one that might come up could be baseline psychiatric mood, for example, disturbance, especially if it's not well controlled. We know that lorlatinib does cause in about 20% of patients mood side effects. Fortunately, they're usually grade 1 or 2. I think only 1% or so was grade 3. But these can occur in patients. So again, if you have a baseline maybe poorly controlled mood disorder, I think lorlatinib could definitely worsen that, and it could be very hard for them to tolerate. We did actually have that experience more than once. And so that is a condition, a comorbid condition, that often gives me pause and could sway me to use a second-generation inhibitor instead of lorlatinib. Curious.
So I was thinking, some patients, it's rare, but they may have awful neuropathy because of other conditions. And alectinib, I never saw neuropathy, and I don't think that was ever reported as a side effect to that drug. So if it's really limiting their quality of life, I would be a little concerned. I don't know if in your experience, like a 50 milligram dosing is associated with a lower incidence of neuropathy, but besides the psychiatric condition, I think it would give me pause in deciding that.
Yeah, I mean, the neuropathy with lorlatinib, I mean, there definitely is some, but it's quite variable in my experience, and not all patients have it, and then some patients have pretty severe neuropathy, so hard to predict. I do think it's dose-dependent, though, so perhaps that would be a reason to consider the lower dose.
And someone put in the question, which I think is a great one. What about patients who might have some underlying cognitive disorder, specifically dementia? Sometimes we have patients who have some mild symptoms at baseline or even develop it on treatment. How do you approach that?
Yeah, I worry about that as well. I think you mentioned this when you're talking about older patients where you might even start lower because, again, of the neurocognitive issues. And a lot of those neurocognitive issues are related to, for example, multitasking, to short-term memory, and things that could certainly worsen an underlying, even mild dementia. So I do think about that. As many of you know, though, many of our ALK patients tend to be younger. So, in fact, I haven't encountered this too often. But that would be another reason to maybe think carefully about selecting lorlatinib.
And I think if we do choose, because depending on the degree of dementia, I would be even more conservative and start with the 50 milligrams perhaps in this patient population.
Absolutely. And someone also, I think another important point is that, you know, what do you, how do you separate underlying psychiatric conditions versus depression with diagnosis? Of course, many of our patients will have mood disturbance at the time of diagnosis. And I think it's really a matter of talking with patients, ensuring that you're supporting them in all the ways that we can, you know, whether that be palliative care, psycho-oncology. I think we all agree that, you know, based on this data, lorlatinib is the best agent for these patients. And so we want to try to avoid, you know, using an alternate agent unless we really are in a situation where we feel like can't tolerate it. Bruna, I think a practical question in terms of the cardiovascular risk, how often do you check lipid panels for these patients? Do you, you know, check them every time they come in? Is there a frequency with which you're doing it?
So at the beginning, I do check more often because I want to see what's going to happen. It's not 100% that will have high cholesterol. So I do the early check-in in 2 weeks, and also because of other toxicities, I like to see them in 2 weeks. But after that, if I started them on a statin and they are doing well in 4 weeks, then I would not do every month. For instance, then I would just do every 3 months like cardiologists do, you know, unless it's not trending down as I expect it to.
Great. So going back to a question that came in earlier, but I think it's an important topic to spend a moment talking on about, which is what do we do with these patients after we've kind of exhausted all of these excellent first-line treatment options? And specifically, again, maybe a question to both of you, how do you approach patients with progression, let's say on first-line lorlatinib? Hopefully, you know, this is something that we're not encountering too often because patients are able to stay on for a long time, but when they do progress, how are you approaching the need for any repeat testing? Are you doing repeat liquid biopsy? Are you doing liquid tissue biopsy? And how do they impact your treatment? So Bruna, maybe I'll start with you. And
yeah. So I am a fan of liquid biopsy, but I also know the limitations. So I will try to get tissue. So if they have some lesion that I can biopsy, by all means, I'll do that and do the tissue NGS and liquid and then make a decision. If there's nothing that I can target, I do like the data that Jessica Lin's group presented in TTLC, adding chemo to targeted therapy. I know it's off-label, but this is something that I would do in the absence of anything that I can target with a different drug or a clinical trial.
Yeah, I mean, I would mention that for patients on first-line lorlatinib, I mean, it is, I think the CROWN data does play out in the real world. I've had very few patients actually relapsing, fortunately, on first-line lorlatinib, but I think when we do see those patients, for sure, I do consider both liquid and tumor biopsies. As Bruna said, liquid biopsies can miss things, but on top of that, you know, we do know that even ALK-positive lung cancer can sometimes transform and become a small cell, and you can really only tell that typically from a tumor biopsy, so I usually want to rule out small cell transformation. That would obviously have a huge implication for future treatments. And I think what we're looking for on the tissue and the liquid biopsies is something potentially targetable. So is there MET amplification? That one we do know a fair amount about across many different other oncogene-driven cancers, and that can potentially be targeted with a MET TKI like capmatinib or tepotinib added to an ALK TKI. And there are other potentially targetable mutations or rearrangements that we would also be looking for. So I do think repeat biopsy is something that we would definitely want to encourage if a patient's relapsing on the lorlatinib.
And what do we know about ALK resistance mutations, specifically in the setting of lorlatinib progression?
So after first-line lorlatinib, we don't know that much. We only have, so far at least, data from the CROWN trial. We presented this, again, at ASCO, looking at liquid biopsies that were taken on patients at end of treatment, so progressing on lorlatinib or crizotinib. And actually, it was a relatively small number because not that many patients, fortunately, have progressed. But there were no ALK mutations identified so far in those liquid biopsies. There were a couple of other types of alterations, particularly affecting the RAS-MAP kinase pathway. But I think the jury's still out in terms of what's going to be driving resistance to first-line lorlatinib, hence the importance of us doing these biopsies.
Awesome. Well, maybe in the last minute, a forward-thinking question to end on a hopeful note. You know, what are you most excited about kind of looking forward? Alice, you mentioned some next-generation ALK inhibitors. There's a lot of work being done in ADCs. Where do you see the future for patients with ALK-positive lung cancer? And we'll wrap up. Bruna, I'll start with you.
So honestly, I am not sure if one agent will be enough in the second line setting. It may be that we need really combination therapies because as Alice showed, even lorlatinib in second line, you have that median PFS of 6 months, which is basically what you get with chemo platinum doublet. So I think the strategy would be a combination therapy in the second line setting.
You know, we didn't spend much time today talking about the fourth generation drug. I just mentioned it briefly. That's NVL-655, NVL-655. I think that is a good one to keep an eye on. It's a fourth generation. It was specifically designed to not only be potent and highly CNS penetrant, but also to overcome not just single but double or compound ALK resistance mutations, and also to not inhibit other targets like TRK that can probably cause, that are probably causing some of the side effects with lorlatinib. I mentioned that so far the data that's been presented from the phase one of NVL-655 looks really promising in terms of efficacy, even in lorlatinib-treated patients. But I think what's particularly exciting for many of us is that the safety profile of NVL-655 is really encouraging. It has very few toxicities. I think transaminitis was the most common toxicity, only in about 15 or 20% of patients, and really almost no other, like no neurocognitive effects, no mood effects, minimal neuropathy. And so I do think that's an important ALK inhibitor to keep an eye on as it moves forward in clinical trials.
Awesome. And I'll just highlight, you know, I think there's also exciting data with some of the antibody drug conjugates. We've talked so much about those, but with datopotamab deruxtecan, you know, the data with actionable genomic alterations included patients with ALK, so another kind of class of drugs to keep an eye on. Well, with that, I'd like to thank my co-panelists for an excellent presentations and I think a really robust discussion. It was really fun to do this. Thank you to the audience for all of the great questions in the chat. And thank you to everyone for attending this program. We hope you'll join us at another PER event soon. On the iPads, you'll see the link to the CME. Please complete the evaluation to claim your CME credit. This will remain available until March 19th. Thank you so much for your attention.